Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
I hear this often. It's like, well, this is what they do in Norway. It's what they do in Denmark. Why can't we do that here? The population of Denmark is 5.8 million people. That's less than New York City, right? And if you want to look at like the demographic info on that, it's probably very, very homogenous, right? So very, very difficult to compare. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be implementing the things that work that we can do, but just for context.
Having a homogenous population just makes it that much easier to push through a robust welfare system. Though I will say, I think this is an important thing to note. The tax systems in Scandinavia are actually far more regressive than they are than is being advocated for by like a Bernie and an AOC, as in they tax the middle class very heavily in order to pay for their social programs. And you have like the Bernies and the AOCs of the world wanting to just sort of tax the super wealthy, which is wonderful in theory but very hard to pull off in practice.
Welcome back to Yang Speaks on your Thursday update. This is your co-host, Zach Grauman. We're back with the wonderful and unique fireball that is Carly Riley. Welcome back.
My adjectives are changing.
They're going to change every week.
Unique and fireball?
Depending on how the week before went. So here's the deal, and you're getting familiar with this every Thursday, at least this summer, as we start to ramp up what we're going to kind of launch this fall. We're going to dive in on a topic every week, both Carly and myself, and talk about what we're missing, what you're missing in the mainstream
what
press.
What we're all missing.
That's true. It's collective. So I'm coming at you live from a bougie hotel. I didn't pay
coming
for
at you very much not live, but
not live. That's true. Coming at you from, I'm in this, if you're watching the video, I look a little ridiculous with a bed in the background. Anyway, it's best I got. But today's topic is socialism. And it's relevant because of what we're seeing in the news on Cuba. And Carly and I were diving in, like, let's do an episode on Cuba. And we're like, the reason this is complicated is because we're talking about the term socialism. And frankly, both sides aren't very clear on what they mean by the term. And as an average listener, you're like, I'm not really sure what we're talking about and why people are digging in on the right and the left. So let me see if I get this right before we dive in. What we're seeing from the Republicans and the right and the left, is saying kind of what they've always been saying, is that socialism is the root of all evil. They're the boogeyman in some ways to keep the status quo, but they're like, communism, socialism, terrible, stay away. And the Democrats have been now making this argument that capitalism is bad and that the socialist countries have gotten this right, call it Denmark, Finland, Sweden. And we're all kind of confused, but are they actually socialist over there or not?
I think it's not clear that those countries are socialist. In fact, I'll make the argument here that they're very clearly not socialist. It's not that I think that Bernie Sanders thinks he's confused about that. I think that's what's muddied the water, is you have had some really prominent politicians recently over the last X number of years talking about socialism and saying they mean things that don't really mean socialism.
Correct.
So we'll talk about it.
And so in Cuba right now, which we will dive into and give you guys some more info on it, but basically we're seeing the people of Cuba are are standing up, creating massive protests in the country against its communist government or socialist government, depending on what we'll define it here. The left is saying, or the right is saying, support the people because communism is evil. And the left is now saying, we stand with the people of Cuba, but the U.S. is at fault for this, not the communist system. So we'll talk about it, but it's reignited this fight.
I think the Democrats are being really careful not to comment on communism at all. Like, they're not saying it's not the fault of the communist system. They're just sort of sidestepping that altogether by saying, hey, we stand with the Cuban people. And also, by the way, we should end this embargo, which, by the way, I agree with, having now dug into this, like this embargo, it, you know, it's been in place in some form or another for 80 years and hasn't changed anything. I do think at this point, the Obama pivot that he made, which was sort of a different approach than other governments had, other presidents had made in the past, was probably right. But maybe we dive into that a little bit more.
Let's dive into this because I think, we're being fed this kind of false narrative. And my goal,
nothing
and our goal
like somebody right now, in a bougie hotel talking about socialism.
That's true. Here we are.
Nothing says I'm a capitalist like
so
your background.
So that's the purpose of this episode. I want you all to listen and understand when people are using the term socialism and throwing it out there, what they actually mean, what they think they mean, and help you decide where you stand in terms of what you're telling your kids, telling your friends, and what you vote for up and down the ballot, and where you stand in this like nonsense narrative. So Carly, let's start. I want to start with the basics. And I think you're in some way, you've been a like a Warren Buffett fan since you were a small child. So I think you're relatively qualified to give us like a lay of the land on what socialism is and then how these both our Democrats and Republicans are defining it.
Sure. So like traditionally speaking, and if you look in the dictionary for like a definition of socialism, it's when the means of production, the profits from a system are owned by a collective. So that could mean the workers of a company. Obviously, in most cases, it's ended up meaning government in some capacity.
Right. In practice, usually government, right? Yeah.
In practice, it often ends up being government. But the idea is that profits and the means of production are publicly owned as opposed to privately owned. So it's about if you nationalize certain industries, right? That's why we talk about socialized medicine, because if you're nationalizing healthcare, that's socializing healthcare. And like a good example, there was a pizza shop recently that decided to turn over all the profits from the pizza shop to the workers of the pizza shop. And so, of course, suddenly they started making, these workers were making like $78 an hour. And you had all these like leftists on Twitter, et cetera, heralding this as an example of the kind of world they want to see, where the profits, instead of accruing to the owners of the pizza shop, it becomes like this collective where the profits accrue to everyone who works within the pizza shop. So that would be another example of like a socialist system. And then when you talk about like what the right and the left mean by it, I think the right actually kind of means that, right? Like they're looking at the USSR, they're looking at China, though I think China's an interesting case because China is really quite capitalist at this point.
Yeah, but at least historically where China
historically speaking,
has been.
And then they're looking at Cuba. They're looking at these kinds of countries that have most industries heavily nationalized. In Cuba right now, 88% of the people in Cuba are employed by the government. Like everything is essentially nationalized. And they're looking at all of the worst examples, right? They're looking at the USSR and the mass famines there. They're looking at the mass famines that happened in China under, you know, Mao and communism. And so that's their focus. Or, you know, and they're using that honestly to galvanize Latin American votes. Like that's what you saw in Miami, you know, in this past election cycle, was with these folks, a lot of people who'd come from Cuba, and they're fear-mongering saying, hey, the Democrats are socialists. They're going to turn the United States into Cuba, the place you fled, et cetera, et cetera. Venezuela, gets mentioned a lot, though. Again, there's questions about really is Venezuela actually a socialist country.
And you said this earlier, Carly, is that socialism and communism defined, at least this traditional definition that you're talking about, it doesn't really exist anymore. Except for Cuba and probably North Korea.
North Korea.
Right?
Well,
right.
This is what's so interesting. And
so those are not players in the global economic stage.
I mean, they're two of the most dysfunctional countries.
Yeah.
In many ways in the world. I mean, and in Cuba, the left does like to hold up that Cuba has a really actually strong healthcare system in some ways. That's true. I had a friend who actually got a grant to study in Cuba and study their healthcare system. It's a whole other thing. Like there are elements of Cuba that they get very right. But they're also, as you can see based on these protests, a huge mess. Okay, when you talk about what the left, how the left defines socialism. This is where it gets a lot more confusing, because you have people like AOC and Bernie who have been very adamant that when they talk about socialism, when they talk about being democratic socialists, they're looking at countries like Norway and Sweden and Finland. I think AOC Denmark, one time mentioned the UK. These countries that have these really robust social safety nets, but like are free market economies. And it feels like AOC and Bernie and a lot of these folks, Rashida Tlaib, have sort of co-opted the term socialism to mean something quite different than it originally and historically has always meant. I mean, one like anecdote that I just found incredibly amusing as I was digging into all of this is in 2015, in the lead up to the 2016 election, Bernie Sanders obviously was on the trail talking about democratic socialism. He was trying to clarify what he meant by that. He's like, you know, I mean, Norway. And then the prime minister of Norway comes and gives a talk at Harvard Kennedy and was like, I literally don't know what he's talking about. Like, we're not a socialist country. We're a very free market economy. He's literally like, we have a free market economy. Like, we have a really robust welfare system. We have high taxes.
Take care of our poor. Right. Yeah.
So that seems to be the critical, call it misunderstanding, the way that right now the right and left are talking past each other. And I do have to say, it does feel like it's been the left that has muddied these waters.
Yes. Because it doesn't, this is what I'm passionate about, is that it doesn't fit the left's narrative very well. In that, if the right's like socialism is bad and evil, the left is like, when this happens, they naturally want to say, well, socialism is good. But the reality is, at least in a traditional definition of socialism and communism, there's a fact, not Zach's opinion, it's not Carly's opinion, it has never worked. There's not one example of socialism in that truest definition actually working. The closest ones that we're talking about, that it appears that the left kind of picks and chooses what they want to talk about or what they want to hold up as a good example, are your Finlands and Denmarks and Swedens and some of the countries that have great social safety nets, which, and don't get me wrong, those countries are doing great. They're doing better than us by the numbers.
But, and, well, let's talk about when we say it has never worked, I think it's worth breaking that down a little bit more for folks. So we said earlier, like, there are very few countries left that are actually socialist. So if you dig online, if you look at sort of experts talk about this, really there are five countries that are get held up as sort of still being socialist. And they are Cuba and North Korea, and then China, Vietnam, and Laos. But what's so interesting is China, Vietnam, and Laos all have pretty healthy private sectors in their economy at this point. And Vietnam in particular is interesting, especially as we're talking about Cuba, because Vietnam and Cuba have a close relationship. Vietnam has been sort of an advisor to Cuba. The ambassador to Cuba has spoken very publicly. The ambassador to Vietnam in Cuba has spoken publicly a lot. And one of the anecdotes that I believe he actually brought up recently, this ambassador, was this ambassador in Cuba said, to build socialism with success, it is necessary to develop a market economy in an adequate and correct way. So already you sort of have this contradiction where it sort of feels like your China, your Vietnam, your Laos are like holding on to the idea of communism and socialism in name, but not really in practice. And of course, they have a lot of central control there. They do have much more state-owned enterprises than the United States, for example. But he's coming out and saying you need this private enterprise. So back X number of decades ago, Vietnam was importing most of their rice, most of their agriculture, and they wanted to stop being so dependent on other countries. So the Communist Party there did a study on their agricultural sector. And they discovered that while most of the land that was being farmed was owned by the government, there was about 5% of the land in total that private farmers were allowed to own. And that 5% of land was accounting for half of the entire country's food production. Essentially, the private, when there was an incentive and you felt like you owned it, the results of the food production were way, way better. So what did Vietnam do? They made all agricultural land privately owned. They turned all of the state-owned plots over to private farmers, and they lifted like 20 million people out of poverty that way because they suddenly could independently feed their entire country. So like when we talk about socialism has not historically worked, this is what we're talking about. The countries that are still sort of holding on to it have developed really robust private markets, and that's when their people started lifting out of poverty.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
What I want to dive into is the socialist wing of the Democratic Party, because I think, and it is worth talking about, because one, what's happening right now is, I love this Cuban narrative, which we'll get into, but Joe Biden and co, the left is saying, we stand with the Cuban people, but we have issues with like the historical US embargoes, and like, we're not necessarily putting the square blame on the socialist government of Cuba, because there's a strong wing, or at least a very public vocal wing of the left that is identifying with socialism. And the biggest one is the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. And look, they are fighting for, I mean, Carl, you can define this pretty well, but they want to, it seems to me they want to take the traditional definition of socialism and evolve it. And there's a lot, they have elected candidates up and down the ballot, you know, AOC and Bernie is, I don't think he's publicly a DSA candidate, but he's been endorsed by them.
And calls himself a democratic socialist.
Right. And look, they have a lot of policies that many agree with that aren't identifying as socialist, whether it's Medicare for all, or they organize really, really well on a grassroots level. They believe in really strong labor unions. They believe in the Green New Deal, which we could probably do a whole episode on Green New Deal. But the spirit of the Green New Deal, I think, is generally a good thing. But they also have a lot of other policies on their website that aren't necessarily fantastic for, let's call it capitalism, or the majority of Americans.
Well, opinions. Forget that. I mean, their platform explicitly calls for an end to capitalism.
Yeah, so this is where you talk about open borders, which I don't.
You
I think
say they're trying to evolve socialism. I read their platform, which you can find on their website, and to me, it reads like up and down socialism. They call for an end to capitalism. They call for nationalizing all sorts of sectors. Again, ironically, sectors that are not nationalized in the Scandinavian states. Like, they want the telecom sector nationalized. Like, Sweden liberalized and denationalized their telecom sector back in the 80s. Like, there's this very interesting thing that I've discovered as I've dug into this, which is like, AOC says she's a member of the Democratic Socialist Party, but then says what she means by socialism is Sweden. But then her party is describing socialism a la Cuba, not a la Sweden. And I don't really know how we reconcile these things. And I don't know if this is just a marketing ploy, for lack of a better term, on AOC's front, because it's, you need to have a term for what you are, and she's picked socialism. I don't know if it's that she likes the majority of the DSA's policies, but maybe feels a little differently on some of the nitty-gritty policies here. I don't really know the answer to that. Because the DSA does, they talk about a whole bunch of things. They're a lot about equity, a lot about, you know, feminism, racial justice, ending the carceral system. They have all sorts of policies in that wing of things, in that vein, some of which I fully agree with. I would imagine you do as well. And then they have the economic policies and the economic pieces of their platform, which read to me very much like traditional socialism. And they do this thing where they have this line, like, we want socialism without the authoritarianism. And it feels a little bit like, you know, having your cake and eating it too.
I think that's a worthwhile question. So, because we ran for president with Andrew on the concept of human-centered capitalism, which you could also argue is having your cake and eating it too. Like, you know, can you have a capitalist society that values human beings as their intrinsic value as opposed to just dollars and cents? And like, can we take the best parts of capitalism and build it into something more different? And my question is there a same, not that I agree with it, but is there a same existence in the socialism world? Can you evolve, take the good parts of socialism, let's call it a robust safety net and maybe some more equity?
Robust safety net is not socialism. I think this is where...
But I agree, but it's part of their platform, right?
I don't think so. Let me say why. Human-centered capitalism, what Andrew was advocating, still would involve hierarchies. He's just saying instead of putting profits at the top, instead of saying profits rule everything, he would say, hey, we should start having mental health rule everything. We should start having, concern about the climate rule everything. Yeah. But you're inevitably still going to have powerful people and non-powerful. Like power abhors a vacuum. Correct. You're going to have winners and losers. But how we're determining those winners and losers isn't hinging upon profits. Socialism fundamentally is trying to pretend, in my view, human nature doesn't exist as it does. It's trying to pretend that we can suddenly flatten everything, eliminate hierarchies, eliminate winners and losers, eliminate power, and everything can exist within this, like, owned by the workers. You know, I mean, I guess you could argue they're trying to put the workers at the top, but then nobody's going to take risks to start businesses if they're not reaping. They're trying to flatten things in a way that to me is completely unrealistic because power abhors a vacuum. And so that's the difference to me is saying,
right,
great. I mean, like, lovely. Wouldn't we all love that the world was beautiful and fair and, you know,
it'd be wonderful.
People,
we can hold hands, sing kumbaya. It'll be great.
And the proof is in the pudding. Like, you had a socialist country in Vietnam where people were starving. And, like, mass famine has been such a chronic problem in socialist societies. You have them turn their food production to a private free market system. And suddenly, the country is well fed. Like, it's... And there's this very, very strange thing that happens on the far left. And you see it on leftist Twitter. You know, I've been tracking these to genuinely try and understand and take a sympathetic view. I'm not just trying to, you know, entrench myself in an opinion I already hold. But they're like, it's so funny how people are so excited to criticize communism when you look at like how bad things are in capitalism. And it's like, yeah, you're right. Like it's a totally imperfect system. But we're saying when you wait it out, it's proven to be
the other ones.
A hell of a lot more effective. And every other socialism has collapsed nearly everywhere.
Well, one of the challenges I have with your pizza analogy before where you share the profits with all the workers, and generally speaking, like I believe that like in somewhat, I think workers should be paid more and that sort of thing. But and I hate that. I think this, but the big but, frankly, is it takes a lot of work and risk and time and energy to start a pizzeria. You have to go, you have to file the paperwork, you have to upfront the capital to build, buy the ovens, buy the real estate, and you have to hire the people, you have to put up with their bullshit when they don't show up for work and all, someone's charge. And so, if you're telling the person, hey, you want to start a pizzeria, you have to do all this work. Oh, and then when you get there, you don't get to reap the financial rewards. You have to share it with all the people that just got to show up. And what happens is you de-incentivize creating anything.
You are asking people to subsume any level of self-interest. And that's just not realistic in the animal kingdom writ large. This is not like a human
but the,
only
and the left
problem.
Will argue, but the left, and the left will argue, well, there's a certain amount of privilege to be able to take all that risk and that sort of thing, which in some instances I do very much agree with. But that is a problem you can actually solve within a capitalist system, I believe. And that's a problem we're focusing on, like opportunity and access and better education down the list, as opposed to solving it by having a socialist equality of outcome situation.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
I'm curious your thoughts on this movement in general, because I think on one hand, they've got, I think publicly have recently said they've got 94,000 members in the DSA. They, as of in 2017, or in 2013, their median age was 68. And in 2017, that median age of members is 33. So it is dropped. Like, young people are swarming to this let's call it young activists are swarming to this in a relatively powerful way, in the sense that they now have, there are four elected members of Congress who the DSA has helped put over the finish line and get into office. That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman. In addition, there's a whole bunch of other city council candidates nationwide. I think it's 36. There's five in Pennsylvania. There's seven in New York. They own the Democratic Party in Nevada in terms of leadership positions. And a mayor in Buffalo, India Walton, is a socialist who just won the primary there. So what's the future of this?
Well, this feels to me like a classic example of, I almost hesitate to say the extremes getting elected in like primary systems, but this is not a very big movement. The Libertarian Party has 600,000 members, right? Mm. It has 6x the number of members that the DSA has.
But so there's not by many the Libertarian numbers, members of Congress, right?
Well, this is what's interesting. There's this disconnect between the number of, like, call it rank and file official members of the DSA and their representation in Congress. And look, it's worth saying again, like, what AOC is talking about, I don't mind, right? Like, Sweden, Norway, I mean, I think there are other reasons that it's silly to try and compare us to them, but I don't have a problem with that. But it is interesting to me that there's this disconnect between what she's saying she wants and what her party is saying their platform is. That's the piece that's odd about this. So I think, look, I think we're going to continue to see this movement appeal to people. I think as we have more probably natural disasters a la COVID, a la disasters that are brought on by climate change, people are only going to get increasingly sick of, call it, the way things are. I also think many of the ways our system is currently failing are the ways that we are not capitalist. And what I mean by that is, like, corporate socialism, like the way we bail out these big companies. And there's a lot of socialism at the top right now, in a way that I think makes people very mad, and they misidentify it as needing more socialism as opposed to needing proper capitalism at the top. And I think all of this is going to only fuel young people to be more interested in this movement, which, again, it could go either way to me. That could be a great thing, and we could just navigate more into a Medicare for all system, or it could be a troubling thing, and people could get deeper into wanting a socialist communist system that I think is entirely unrealistic and kind of a bizarre thing to advocate for. What do you think?
And I'll say, I'll just add quickly to your point, like, talking about why it's different here than there. We could probably do a whole episode, but for example, the reason we can't, I hear this often, it's like, well, this is what they do in Norway, it's what they do in Denmark. Why can't we do that here? The population of Denmark is 5.8 million people. That's less than New York City, right? And if you want to look at, like, the demographic info on that, it's probably very, very homogenous, right? So very, very difficult to compare. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be implementing the things that work that we can do, but just for context. Now, I think—
Sure. And when we say it's all white people, I mean, you know, certainly there are welfare programs that haven't been pushed through. There's a lack of a robust welfare state here, certainly because of racism and because you have a lot of white people and white people in power, frankly, who see welfare as like a wealth transfer from like hardworking white people to lazy people of color, like that there's a really dark, dark narrative. And so having a homogenous population just makes it that much easier to push through a robust welfare system. Though I will say, I think this is an important thing to note. The tax systems in Scandinavia are actually far more regressive than they are than is being advocated for by like a Bernie and an AOC, as in they tax the middle class very heavily in order to pay for their social programs. And you have like the Bernies and AOCs of the world wanting to just sort of tax the super wealthy, which is wonderful in theory, but very hard to pull off in practice. No Scandinavian country except for Norway.
Yes.
They tried a wealth tax and it repealed it. Sweden tried a wealth tax, repealed it. I believe Finland tried a wealth tax, repealed it. That's obviously the big Elizabeth Warren thing that, again, sounds great in theory. Democrats judge policies based on their intentions, not based on their results.
Look at this jingle. This is Carly's jingle. Okay. let's
I want to close out just what? Cuba. Were you going to say Cuba?
I wanted to talk about Cuba and why this matters. So, just a hammer out some facts on what's going on in Cuba. The Cuban people are protesting like crazy. The main things that have, at least they've publicly come to us in terms of their why they're protesting, has been lack of food, lack of access to COVID vaccines, or just like mishandling of COVID in general. And then there's now been, I think the last final straw was these blackouts or electricity shortages. And they have gotten more access to the internet in recent years, starting a little bit in 2014 and really accelerating 2018. Historically, we have always had an embargo on Cuba because we don't like communism in the United States. We don't think it should exist. Bad things happen. At least that's been our stance on it. So like since 1960, we've been putting embargo with trade. We don't allow trade to happen between Cuba and the United States besides food and medicine. And that's fluctuated in a number of different ways. Obama eased this in 2014, which is why you saw more internet access in Cuba and a little more tourism. And Trump came in and revoked it, said absolutely not. And Biden hasn't touched it yet.
And this is an important thing to focus on for a minute, the Obama easing it, because something that I've heard and that makes a lot of sense to me is you had this hope start to exist in Cuba when Obama came in and eased the restrictions and opened the way for tourism and opened their economy, you know, or helped their economy in that way. And what's happened over the last year and a half, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever it's been, was like a walk back of that hope. And there is there's a pattern in like international affairs where revolutions start when things start to get a little better and then get worse again.
The haves become the have-nots.
It's not just abject poverty or abject misery. It's when people start to think things might get better and then that gets pulled back from them. Right. That's when you start to see, in many ways, what we're seeing, which is for the first time you have people in Cuba acknowledging that they're living under a dictatorship. For years, they couldn't even say that publicly, or they were too afraid to say that publicly because it was taboo. And the other thing I want to point out, and then we can continue on with this narrative, is there's really three things that have happened recently. You had Trump reimposing stricter sanctions, embargoes, et cetera, on the country after Obama. You also have the collapse of Venezuela, and
Venezuela came in when we were not giving them any like trade or.
Well, specifically, Venezuela provided them with heavily subsidized oil, so they were reliant on heavily subsidized oil from Venezuela, and that sort of collapsed. And then you have COVID, obviously, hit. So these three factors sort of all hit at once, on top of existing struggles, frankly, because of communism, because you have 88% of the population working for the government, because you have a centrally planned economy, because you don't have private markets. And that's been devastating.
Yep. And so I'm fascinated by this narrative because no one's really talking about it. I don't think we can actually say for certain that this is the case. But if I'm as a political strategist, this is where my head is at, that Obama was like, okay, let's ease this up. Let's help the Cuban, like the embargo that the US has put on Cuba is hurting the people of Cuba. I mean, it's less money in the country, right? Less everything. So Obama eases it. Trump puts it back. Theoretically, Biden could quickly say, hey, we're going back to what we did in the Obama era. I mean, he could do that, right? However, the big, and we mentioned this earlier in this podcast, is the big factor that no one's been talking about is the reason Biden lost Florida is because of Cuban Americans that do not like living in Miami, Dade County, that do not like the Cuban government and are in Miami because they want an escape from that. And by the way, if like you look at the numbers in Florida, they thought Duval County, where Jacksonville is, if they flip that blue, they're going to win because Miami is always Democratic. And Miami did go Democrat, but it was less. It's usually like 80-20. I think it was 60-40 Dem Republican. And that's massive. And if there's, I would say like if that keeps shrinking, there's no chance of winning Florida for the Dems realistically anytime soon. So there's that piece, this puzzle, which I think is fascinating in this narrative.
And you've got Biden coming out, the Biden administration and his spokesfolks are coming out saying like, hey, it's just that it's first things first for us right now. We're focusing on COVID recovery, et cetera, et cetera. So this is just not a top priority for us right now. That's their talking point for why they're not going back to Obama era policies. I think your take is obviously very interesting. And, you know, there's been arguments that that's why Trump did what he did was to, I mean, he made the announcement about renewed sanctions on Cuba in Miami-Dade County, like to a group of Cuban Americans, while he's hammering how socialist the Democrats are. So it's a tragic situation. I don't like the embargo. I don't think it's helpful. I think it is just hurting the people of Cuba. I think we have a better shot of getting Cuba to call it, I would say, modernized. I'm sure that'll piss people off, but by building these bridges to Cuba, which was what Obama was trying to do. But there are clearly all sorts of political considerations that beyond just the Cuban people.
I have two questions that I think I'd like to wrap this topic on. One, I want to talk about the future of the party in general, and then I want to talk about how we as consumers of media can like navigate this, because that's the goal of this. So let's start with the future of the party. We kind of touched on this a bit. I think the pressure, I'll start my opinion on this. I think the pressure from the DSA type candidates is going to increase, not decrease, because it's good news fodder. It's good material, right? Where Black Lives Matter is coming out and saying we support the people of Cuba, but we also blame the US government for doing this. You have DSA saying something similar. You end up with like Bernie and co all like trying to thread this needle, but it keeps this like we like socialism. We don't like all of it. In the headlines, and the Republicans will always keep adding fuel to this fire, because anytime they hear the word socialism, they're like, oh, that's the devil.
This is how they win elections. This is their like just hammer it all day long, baby.
So I think the Republicans will continue in elections by this, because I think the average American doesn't like socialism. But do you think that starts to shift, or you think the Dems start getting more wins in here, or like the four candidates have happened? You might get to 8 to 10 in Congress, but that they start to become the exception, not the rule. What are your thoughts on where it goes?
It depends on what they decide to focus on. If these candidates keep their message about Medicare for all and our current economic system is unfair without suggesting
inequality.
If they keep it on that, I think you'll see a lot more traction. I think where it gets muddied is you have a lot of people who are in that vein also adopt a lot of talking points around identity, race, justice on that stuff. And whatever you think, I mean, obviously I'm actually in favor of a lot of that, but I think the talking points around them are often very unhelpful for winning elections. If you continue to see that side of things really bleed into the economic side of things, I think you'll continue to have what you have, which is pockets of this succeeding, but by and large, the country actually reacting very much against it and going the other direction. If you have candidates that are sticking strictly to the economics of it, which was really Bernie in 2016, that was more his lane, I think you could see more traction in a way that I actually support. How about you?
I think, and this is probably answer my second question too, like how we should consume this. To me, I think the data is very overwhelming and the historical anecdotes are overwhelming that socialism in the way it's traditionally defined is bad. It is a bad thing. It's never worked. If you're consuming these media, the way that AOC and Bernie and others are talking about socialism, they are using that term. So that can be scary, but they're not theoretically, they're not always talking about, they're more talking about Sweden and Norway, Denmark than they are talking about
Which
Cuba,
means
Venezuela,
socializing certain industries like healthcare. Side note, Sweden, for example, has private health insurance in addition to public. Like,
I think the way, and I think what all of us as consumers need to try and understand that when this term is thrown around on both sides of the aisle, there's different definitions that people are using, and it's important to try to understand what they mean. But I think the real future is, I think India Walton, who's the woman who just won the Democratic primary in Buffalo for mayor, beating at least two-term incumbent. Now, I love Buffalo. Go Bills. Love you, Josh Allen. But I don't live in Buffalo. I don't claim to know enough about this race. But what I do know, it appears that she ran her race not on, I'm a socialist, but more on power to the people, and that people on the ground or who are closest to these issues can solve them. And it was issue-focused, but from the American she's not calling for an end to capitalism or end to free markets, but more about stopping people piling up at the bottom, this populist version of this. And I think that's the lane, because capitalism has a ton of benefits, but people will pile up at the bottom. And it's the government's job to kind of figure this out and level the playing field in its own way. And great policies can do that. But great policies that actually work, not ones that... frankly, have been proven to keep failing over and over. And that's what's scary. I think if we get more divided, as people start branding themselves in the socialist lane, it's just going to ignite probably more fury on the opposite direction from moderates, not the far right, from people that are like, hey, I believe in a better healthcare system, but I don't like socialism. So I'm going to vote for the guy on the right because they're not talking about that dangerous stuff. And so that's my fear going forward. But it's my hope for you guys now to have an idea of what socialism is defined at generally, how it's being defined by the DSA, how it's being defined by our politicians, and how it's being defined by the right, and hopefully make some rational decisions as you start consuming media.
Slash, where my mind goes, I'm sure most of you are going to have like all sorts of thoughts on what we missed and how we poorly defined
Please.
It.
Yeah.
I once talked about this on Twitter and I got, you know, all sorts of opinions. So we'll get some of that too, but we welcome it.
People are very passionate about this. And I don't love that this stuff is being brought in a positive light, because socialism has not been good.
Well, no. See, that's where I disagree. I mean, I think that totally, of course. Again, the way that it's just that it's being redefined. Like what Bernie and AOC are talking about are not, I mean, I was never a huge Bernie fan, honestly. Like I like the dude as a person fine, but I think there is a lot of unrealisticness in his vision. They're not talking about traditional socialism. That's what's so strange, is they're just sort of redefining the term to mean something that's much more palatable.
And it's going back to the fact that Democrats aren't good at branding things. Because this is
a broader question that I was going to ask as like sort of a leave us with, is why have they chosen to describe this as socialism? Why have they chosen to kind of call redistribution socialism when that's not really been a part of the traditional definition per se? I mean, I guess there's sort of a link there.
Great question. And you play right in the Republicans' hands. So anyway, that's our socialism debate, if you want to call it debate. More of just a rundown for all y'all. Thank you for tuning in. Hope you learned something. Hope you can now spit a couple facts at people the next time someone brings this up in your world. Don't just use it on Twitter. Use it in real life, pretty please. We love you all. Thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for listening.
We'll be back on Monday. We'll be back on next Thursday doing our thing.
You don't have to ask me, when's Yang coming back? Wait, it's Monday. He's coming back Monday.
He's coming back Monday.
I'll be here on Thursday. He'll be here on Monday. If you want him, tune in on Monday.
Yeah, whatever. Yang speaks without Yang. It's just
Yang speaks where Yang doesn't speak.
We love you, Yang. We love you guys. Take care.